So, as you remember, last week I was, I didn't want to start this topic because it's a longer topic and it's best to start from the beginning. So, so far we talked about different ways of setting up experiments, all in the light of learning the world. Here is another approach that is more computer science-like, but the people doing this work are really at the intersection of statistics, computer science, and most important contributions was done by philosophers of science, computational philosophers. So this is what we are going to talk about. Quite likely we will take this and today's meeting and maybe next one, maybe not the whole meeting, we'll see how it goes. So it's really causal discovery from the point of view of this course. We are talking about discovery of causality from data. So let me, Bayesian networks, actually we talked about causal graphs, so it's not a big deal, it's just the same thing. Causal graphs, we have causes and effects. Edges that are directed are essentially representing asymmetry from cause to effects. When a cause causes the effect will not cause the cause, right? It's an asymmetric relationship. Let's see, so I'm skipping through that because it's not that important. The idea of learning them from data or causal discovery is that we can learn parameters of these from a data set, but we can also learn the structure. And this is what is going to be the main focus of this class, this meeting. Oops. So we have a collection of variables, set of variables, and that's essentially variables that somebody has measured for us. Somebody collected the data, measured some variables, and then every record that you see in the table is essentially a simultaneous measurement of variables. If you remember from the very beginning of this course, we looked at tables like this. We looked at individual variables, we looked at distributions, but we also looked at things like scatter plots. Scatter plots were showing us simultaneous measurements of two variables. Of course, in theory, you can have simultaneous measurements of more variables than two. And given a set of variables and measurements over them, what we can do is we can learn an asymmetric model like this, directed acyclic graph, that we can give a causal interpretation. So we can discover causality from observation. I realize this sounds a little bit unorthodox, but believe me, and be a little patient, we'll talk about the foundations of this work. It is sometimes possible to discover causation from data, from observations. And then we can, of course, learn the parameters, and then we have a model that we can use in performing inference. Causality allows us to predict the effects of manipulation. We talked about it. Actually, you've seen, I think, some of these slides. So it's very, very important to know the causal structure of the world. It's not surprising that scientists are focusing on discovering causality, because when you understand causality, you pretty much understand the world. You understand what is happening. You can perform interventions, manipulations, and predict the effects of this observations. When we built this kind of models in AI, Bayesian networks that you saw, they're very close to causal graphs, they are really one of the formalisms used in AI. In fact, this is my area of research, so I have not formally, well, I did take a course on research design, like this course, but I'm not formally trained in teaching how to do set up experiments, but this is what I do actually for a living. This is my area of research. So you've seen these slides, I think, so I'm going to go quickly through them. In the beginning, we talked about causality and causal graphs. When you have a causal graph involving variables, you can read from the graph which things are going to be dependent and independent. So if you have flu and fever, they are related, they are dependent or correlated because of the causal structure, the link between the two. We are no longer going to play with those causal graphs because I hope you understand them, you remember them. I think you've seen also these slides, so I'm going to just rush through to remind you the things that we talked about. The important thing in this graph, which I took out of my head, is that it is subjective. The subjectivity here is in that I decided which variables to include. So I decided to model a simple system in which we have a flat tire in a car and three different causes of that flat tire and several effects, four effects. And the decision which variables to include was mine. As you probably realize, everything in the world is connected. So the causal graphs can span through all the things in the world. And I decided to put an end on them and that, and then just have a smaller graph, a piece of the world. Knife right here is just meant to be a joke. It's a cause of possible cause of injury. It's meant to be a joke to essentially make you realize that it was my decision to include it. Of course, when you analyze data, somebody made those decisions for you. Somebody collected the data, gave them to you, and there were variables in the data. Another thing that is subjective is the way we measure these variables. They can be discrete, yes, no, glass present on the road, but it can be also the amount of glass, so number of glass shards per square meter or something like this. And somebody made those decisions for us. We just have a data set. In any case, if we have a causal graph like this, then we can read from the graph things that are going to be dependent, like glass and flat tire are going to be dependent. Common sense explanation is on the roads that have a lot of glass, there will be more flat tires than on roads that have less glass. So these two are going to go together. In places where you had flat tire, there will be more glass than in other places. Essentially, there is a connection. The same with a chain of variables. If you remember, there were three rules that we talked about. A chain was one of them. A chain of things influencing one another. Everything on that chain is going to be dependent. Common causes, there's a second rule. Common causes make things dependent too. So far we've been talking about structure and what the structure implies on the data, on the dependence. In causal discovery, we are going to go the other way. From the data and the dependencies, we want to deduce the structure. So that's why I'm reminding that, talking about this. In any case, from the structure, we can read the dependence. Common cause will make things, the two things dependent. This is captured, again, you've seen these slides when we talk about causal graphs, by a mathematical condition. It's an axiom, assumption, that sounds as follows formally, but informally, the three rules that we talked about are essentially consequences of the Markov condition. So you can derive them from Markov condition. It's an axiom, but almost everybody uses that in practice. Scientists have known it for a few hundred years, this idea of a common cause that makes things dependent, a chain of events. And people, of course, have tried to give counterexamples. I mentioned to you that philosophers of science usually are interested in new methodologies. when a new methodology shows up, you can be sure that some philosophers of science will want to look at it and see if you can, if the approach, the tools, if they make sense, if they are sound. So of course, when people started doing causal discovery, philosophers started to come up with counterexamples of this, saying, no, this is not holding. But I've looked at them, and I think all of these counterexamples have a good explanation. They are really different things, not complete understanding of things. In general, there were always good responses to those counterexamples. But in the quantum world, which is the world of particles, quarks, and things that are happening in quantum physics, we know that this assumption doesn't hold. We know it. Essentially, but you know, in that world, there are many funny things that we don't fully understand at the intuitive level. But in macro world, the world that we see, that we touch, I think the assumption is quite good, holds well. The consequences, again, you've seen these slides. A chain makes things dependent. Common causes, common ancestors make things dependent. And there's a third consequence. If you have common descendants, then the ancestors become dependent also. This was discovered quite late in 1970s by a German statistician, Nanni Vermuth. The other two were probably known for centuries. People were aware of them, of the common causes and chains of events. People were also aware of conditional independence. So if you condition on something, this is the summary of the three conditions. Conditional independence. If you condition on flat tire, you observe that the tire is flat, then glass, thorns, and nails are going to be independent of accidents, steering problems, noise, and bumpy feelings, because that those chains are going to be broken, cut by the observation. Also, the effects of flat tire are going to be independent, conditionally on flat tire. So people have known this. Of course, the conditional dependence is something new. People realize, oh boy, this is also happening. So these are, the consequences of conditioning. I'm rushing through because you've seen these when we talked about causal graphs. Manipulation theorem, you've also seen that it can be proven very easily through from Markov condition. By the way, Spiritus, Glimmer, and Shiners are all three philosophers, I would say. Maybe philosophers of science, I don't know. Maybe philosophers of science. Anyway, computational philosophy. The intervention theorem, you remember this joke that when you manipulate with something, the other causes of that something become irrelevant. So suicide makes it irrelevant that the samurai had cancer also. You take a knife, cut the tire, the other causes of that flat tire are completely irrelevant. They are not working anymore. We talked about the implications of let's see. You know that, or also in that presentation, I think we had these slides. Selection bias. If you select your subjects based on whatever, let's say, color of the eyes, if you remember, then the danger is that there will be other chains, causal chains, through which the two variables are dependent. And you remember the picture with experimental designs, the fundamental experimental design. So if we have smoking and lung cancer, I went through that also, different ways of explaining that dependence. Each of these graphs explains why they are dependent. I hope you remember that also. Yeah. Whoops. Oh boy, I must have messed up the slides. You remember this one, we also experiments where we have randomization, randomization determines the value of the independent variable. Therefore, that manipulation cuts the arcs, and that's essentially explaining what is happening in randomization in experimental design. Of course, in this domain, we talked about two different hypothetical experiments, smoking and lung cancer, and then, if you remember, intercourse and pregnancy. They were both hypothetical experiments illustrating some things. Of course, you cannot experiment in this domain because no human subjects committee will allow us to conduct an experiment like this. We know too much. We know that smoking probably is dangerous for health. So we cannot experiment here. Two interesting quotes. You haven't seen this, have you? No. So this is Ronald Fisher. Remember, he was the one who made this design, experimental design, the first truly experimental design with randomization. He was a British statistician, very successful in his work, got a Nobel title from the Queen, or the King, probably, King at that time. It was King George, I think. Sir Ronald Fisher. He was doubting until the end of his life that smoking causes cancer. In fact, he said something, I think this is an exact citation, correlation between smoking and lung cancer means as much as correlation between apple imports and rates of divorces. There's also correlation between the two. So essentially he was doubting all the time that there is a causal connection. He was smoking a pipe, and if I remember correctly, he had some problems with cancer. I think it was the mouth gum cancer, maybe from the pipe. Another interesting, funny quote is two people, it was a presidential debate in fall 1992 in US. I remember I watched it, and Al Gore, on the right-hand side, you remember, he got Nobel Prize, unfairly, I think. This was the year that one of the candidates was Irena Sendlerova, and he won that year. I think it was very unfair because he got his Nobel Prize for the promises he was making. Just like President Obama got a Nobel Prize, he was very surprised about that, just, you know, promising that he will do good things in his presidency. I think which was ridiculous, just in case, in the same case in Al Gore. On the left-hand side, you have Dan Quayle, who was the running mate of George Bush Sr., the father of the other president. This was, I think, the second term of Bush, which I believe he got it. I forgot whether he was the president then. He may have gotten the second term. It's more likely for the U.S. president to win the second term, although it's not a rule. This year, probably, I think it looks like Joe Biden will lose, but hard to predict, really. In any case, Dan Quayle, he was, whenever I look at him, he reminds me of a Polish politician. His name often escapes me. Remember the guy who was saying stupid things like, Sześciu Króli, Six Kings, and Rubikoń. It was years ago. He was one of those kind of, you know, promoted at launch by, I think, TVN. Petro, yes. every second sentence, something stupid. The same with Dan Quayle, very similar, you know, similar age, probably similar behavior. I don't know if it's true, but when he was going to Latin America, Central America, apparently he said, but I don't know if it's true, but they were writing this in the... it's a pity I didn't learn Latin at school, because I would be able to talk to you. Something, you know, like that. So they were making fun of him a lot, and he said, my running mate is so good because of him, because of his presidency, the Berlin Wall fell and the Cold War ended. And Al Gore was, I think, much smarter in this kind of conversation. He said George Bush taking credit for the end of Cold War is like a rooster taking credit for the daybreak. So again, referring to a common cause, to the causal explanation. So essentially also, you know, causal language. From the observation that the Cold War ended, you cannot infer that it was the work of George Bush Sr. So experimentation is not always possible. It's a fact. How can you experiment in astronomy? You cannot start manipulating planets or comets or whatever, maybe in science fiction movies, but not in reality. You cannot experiment in many domains because of the practical reasons. Like, how can you experiment in economics? Well, you can. Some communist countries do that. They do experiments, but usually they all fall flatly on the face with a lot of suffering of the population. So very kind of dangerous, risky experiments. Some experiments are just unethical. You cannot do that, like smoking and lung cancer. You cannot do that because they would be probably too dangerous for people. So you need to do whatever you can do if you cannot experiment. In inferring causation from observation, assumptions are critical. Let me give you an example. If I have a correlation between smoking and lung cancer, and I exclude by assumption any common cause between the two, and I know that smoking comes first and then cancer is developed later, I can infer causation, right? Of course, these are very strong assumptions. That would not be a very very revealing inference. It's not very strong. So what we are going to talk about is now the methods that are actually quite powerful, and the assumptions are not, you don't need to make really very strong assumptions. There are two approaches to causal discovery. We are going to talk about both of them, but we are going to spend more time on the first approach, constraint search-based learning, because it's easier to understand. It's easier to understand how it works. The other one is more obscure, and but there is a theorem saying that if you have ideal circumstances, you have the same data sets, a lot of data, and you use the second approach, it's equivalent to the first one. It does the same thing. But it's easier to explain, but it's harder to lay the link between data and causality. So we are going to spend most of the time on constraint search-based learning. That's the one that was developed by the philosophers, Spiritus, Glimmer, and Shiness. The other one was done by computer scientists. So you remember this statement, correlation does not imply causation. It's true, it's truth, only truth, but not the whole truth. You can lie in two ways. You can tell false things, like you can say something that never happened, just outright lying, or you can lie by not telling everything. So, you know, I can complain, somebody, he hit me. But I forget to tell them that I was the first one who hit him, right? That's a way of lying also. And you can lie in both ways. Anyway, this was not maybe on purpose, but the statement correlation does not imply causation is true, only truth, but not the whole truth. That's a formula in court. I'm going to tell truth, only truth, and the whole truth. And you've seen it probably in textbooks, statistical textbooks, and I think it's typically abused because people believe, people say that this is the whole truth, but this is not the whole truth. If you have indeed a correlation between X and Y, by now you know that it can be that X causes Y, Y causes X, there is a common cause that you haven't observed, or the data that you have are biased by a conditioning variable. Remember the example with intensive care units where heart problems and lung problems were correlated just because we collected the data in the intensive care unit. So that can also happen. Here is an example where it's not, there's more to the truth than that statement. It is true that a correlation between two variables does not imply causation. That's true, because we don't know which of these four cases we are dealing with. But if we have a collection of correlations, collection of dependencies in general, then we can establish causality. The proof is simple, really. You have three variables. How many graphs can you have? Well, that's quite easy to calculate. We have three variables. For every pair of variables, you have arrow this way, arrow that way, or no arrow. Three possibilities. So you have how many total graphs do you have? Well, for every pair, and every how many pairs are there? If you have n variables, that's the number of combinations, n over 2. That's how many pairs you have. And for every pair, you have three possibilities. So it's 3 to the power of n over 2 different graphs. And with three variables, I think that's, isn't it 27? I think it's 27. You exclude two graphs because they are cyclic. They are cycles, so that's 25. You can look at every one of the 25 graphs, and you can, using the three rules we talked about, you can show that that only this graph fulfills these four conditions, only this one. So there's no other possibility. If you have three variables, that's the only graph that will behave like that. X and Z are dependent. You see there's a connection between them directly. Y and Z are dependent, the same thing. X and Y are independent. No common cause, no connection. And X and Y are dependent if you condition on Z, on the common effect. So that's the only graph of the 25. Fairly easy proof. So then, if you observe something like this, you can establish causality. This is the only graph that will result in this collection of correlations. So a single correlation does not mean causation, but a group of correlations can actually strongly suggest causation. It implies a graph. How does it work? Well, it's fairly well-grounded in theory. There are theorems, and as you know, in mathematics, we always start from assumptions. Assumptions are called axioms. There are two axioms in this work. The first axiom you already know. We talked about it a lot, Markov condition. Essentially, it tells you, if you look at the graph, you can infer independences in the data. We were doing this in class. We were looking at different variables and asking, are they going to be independent or not? Of course, in the data that are generated by the graph. The second, and the Markov condition is quite uncontroversial, I think. It's quite, I don't think there are any convincing counterexamples to that. As you know, when you have axioms, the whole theory is going to be true unless there's an error in a proof. But if you have axioms, you can have theorems that you prove from the axioms. And of course, if the proofs are correct, the theorems are going to be correct. Are they going to be useful? Well, they are going to be as useful as axioms are close to the world. Yes, if the axioms are not representing anything useful in the world, then the theorems are going to be useless. So it's important that the axioms are making sense, that they are essentially describing the world. In that sense, I'm saying it's controversial or uncontroversial. So Markov condition is quite safe, I think, quite close to the world. Faithfulness, it's an assumption that allows us to make inferences the other way. It says essentially that if two variables are independent in the data, then this has to be reflected in the graph. So there should be no connection between them in the graph. Makes sense? The other way, the connection. This separation is a theoretical condition. I'm not going to get into that. But let's read it graph. Yes, independence implies that you can see it in the graph. Now, this is unfortunately more controversial. Here is one example where it's kind of partially holding. Two causes of HIV virus infection. Sharing a needle with an HIV carrier, as you know, this is a common thing among drug addicts. They share needles without disinfecting them, and they spread the virus among themselves. A second cause is intimate contact with somebody who has HIV. These are two causes, and we have an effect, HIV virus infection. If the infection happens, indeed, they are dependent. Because, if you learn that somebody was a drug addict, that provides evidence for, explains why you have infection, the probability of intimate contact becomes less. So it makes sense. But what if you don't have infection? If you are healthy? I'm healthy. I hope I'm healthy. If you learn that I was not sharing needles, does it tell you anything about my intimate behavior? Nothing. Luckily, this is not a big problem because in the algorithms, you test independence and dependence for every possible state of the child node. And it can be shown that there is at most one state of the child node for which there is independence. It's quite complex, but it is actually impossible that there is independence for every possible state. It's impossible. So what they do in the algorithms is they are checking independence of the parents for every state of the child, and if there is at least one state that makes them dependent, then you declare them to be conditionally dependent. So this is not a big problem. A much bigger problem is existence of multiple paths. If there are multiple paths, it can happen that they are canceling each other. Precisely. Let me show you that in the software, exactly this. I have constructed a graph like this. Let me see if I can, if I have... maybe I have it, have some examples here. Yes, I think this is the example. I constructed the graph myself, so I put the numbers. And it can happen that if you stay up before an exam, on one hand you will learn more, on the other hand you are going to be tired, and the total effect of that is going to be zero. So you see, the exam performance is not changing, despite an observation in this node, which means that staying up before an exam and exam performance are independent of one another. Now, that's bad, because not only they are connected, they are even connected through two different paths. So they should be dependent according to the... faithfulness condition, faithfulness axiom. If we observe in the data that these two are independent in the data, then there should be no connection in the graph, and that is violated here. Essentially, the problem is existence of multiple paths. That's the main problem here. It may happen, even though it's not maybe very likely, but it may happen. There is actually dependence. If you are, let's say, you observe this variable, it has influence on performance. Learning more or learning less will impact performance. It's just that the two paths are canceling each other when you perform, when you observe this. The same here. So these two are independent, and they should be dependent. Essentially, the paths are canceling each other out. So that is a big problem with faithfulness. And what do we do? Well, the assumption does not hold completely. Should we throw it away? Think about another situation. You are conducting an experiment, well-designed, design number 4, randomization, independent variable, manipulating, and then you have the dependent variable. If you observe at the end of the experiment that manipulation of independent variable did not result in a change in the dependent variable, so there was no dependence, no correlation, what do you infer? We typically, in our common sense thinking, infer that that independent variable, like smoking, did not have any effect on cancer. So it's not a cause, right? Statistics, of course, this is what is in our heads, but this is actually not a very sound inference. We shouldn't be thinking like this. Statistics is doing a little bit of dancing around it. They assume null hypothesis, that there is no dependence, and then they reject the null hypothesis. If they observe independence between the two, they say the data were not enough to reject null hypothesis. That's actually the correct, mathematically correct way of stating it. But practically, when you observe that two things are independent in an experiment, you say, well, it didn't cause it, right? And that's also not completely sound inference. We are doing this here. So it's not, there are problems with it, but the problems, people working in this field, they actually have used, let's see, I don't have it. They have proven that an event like this, where two paths are canceling each other exactly, is Lebesgue measure zero. Lebesgue measure zero, it's in set theory. It essentially says that this is very, very unlikely. It doesn't happen too often. That's what it says. So it may happen, but it doesn't happen too often. But keep in mind that when you are dealing with data, two variables are going to be never independent, precisely independent, right? There's going to be always a little bit of, a little bit of noise. So, because of this violation of the faithfulness, the procedures of discovery are going to make sometimes mistakes, errors, statistical errors, essentially. So it is a problem. And now, if we have three variables, remember there was 25 different graphs, different possible graphs. An important thing is that these graphs can be divided into classes of equivalence. I showed you this one. It was possible to discover based on observations. It's possible to identify it uniquely. But it's not always possible to identify a graph uniquely. Look at this, for example. This is a typical case when we have two variables that are dependent, and conditioning doesn't change the dependence. They are still dependent. The third variable is independent. So, of course, we don't know which way this dependence goes. And using statistical tests, we are unable to distinguish between the two, between these two graphs. We can't do it. So statistics and the discovery from data is unable to do it. Look at this one. This is another example. Everything is connected with, everything is dependent because of the common cause here, or a chain in this graph, chain in the other direction in this graph. So everything is dependent. But when you condition on the thing in the middle, this one, or this one, or this one, the dependence between these two disappears. But it happens in every one of these graphs, so you cannot distinguish between them. This is a big set. Everything is connected with everything. Conditioning on anything makes no difference. Dependence is still going to be there. You cannot distinguish between these, among these six graphs. It's undistinguishable. So these are equivalence classes. They are called also classes of statistical indistinguishability. You cannot distinguish them among each other. But from data, you can say which class you are dealing with. And sometimes when you are lucky, you can uniquely discover a graph. This is discoverable. Everything is independent of everything. Unconditional, you don't need to condition. This is the only graph that represents that. So now there is that's kind of a side step. There's a theorem, there's actually a theorem here that refers to indistinguishability. These two graphs are impossible to distinguish from each other just based on the data. The only difference you see is that there's a chain here, and in this graph, this is the common cause of these two. You cannot distinguish them among them. The theorem says that if the structure is the skeleton is the same, so if you disregard the direction of arrows, it's the same. It looks the same, and then the same V structures. V structures are because they resemble the letter V, an effect, common effect, and two causes. That's a V structure. So if they have the same V structures and the same skeleton, they are impossible to distinguish. This one is going to be distinguishable from these two because the set of V structures is different. We have a V structure here and here. How does the algorithm work? It consists of two steps. The first step is pure statistics. We take a data set and we perform independence tests in the data and see, is X independent of Y? Is Y of Z? Is X of Z? And then you try conditional independence. You try everything, many, many statistical tests. As you know, performing many statistical independence tests is not a very good idea. You probably were warned against that in statistics classes, and I also warned you against that. Why was that, remember? If you perform 100 independence tests, at a significance level 0.05, you can expect 5 of these tests to wrongly reject null hypothesis. So if you have a big data set and you try everything, you know, is this dependent of everything, of this, is this dependent of this, then, and you do, let's say, 100 tests, you can expect that 5 tests will falsely show that something is going on. You reject independence, but that's actually just pretty much random. So, we'll talk about this later. What can we do against that, against those many tests? But we perform many tests in that first phase. The second phase is just logic, pure logic. Given the independences, infer what structure could have given those independences. It's almost like on that slide with 4 different conditions and one graph that explains that. That's that second phase. First phase, we'll come back to that later when we talk about the practical side of the algorithm. Two theorems, of course, proven from the two axioms. The first theorem says that there is no edge between X and Y if and only if X and Y are independent, given any subset of variables, including null set. So if you can make them independent, then there is no direct connection between them. Intuitively, it makes sense. Remember, if there is a chain of things connecting, then they are independent. They are dependent. If they are independent, there is no chain in between them. So there is, in particular, no direct connection. Yes. So that's what it says. If you can make things independent, then there is no connection between them, no direct connection. The second theorem is pretty much a theorem about the V structures. It says if we have this structure with X, Y, and Z, here they are, such that X is not directly connected to Z, and we don't know the direction of arrows yet, then if X and Z are independent and Y does not belong to the conditioning set that makes X and Y independent, then this is the only graph that is possible. So that's the V-structure theorem. And then the algorithm. PC is not for personal computer, it's for Peter and Clark. Peter Sputus, Clark Gilmore, two of the guys who wrote who proposed the algorithm. The input is the set of conditional independences. So the first statistical phase, we check dependences, and from there we infer the structure. So input is are the independences, the output is a set of structures expressed by a pattern. More about it in a moment. A pattern represents a collection of graphs. Remember, every graph in the pattern is indistinguishable from each other, given the data. Here's the whole algorithm. I'll just talk briefly about it, and then we'll look at an example. So we begin with a complete graph, undirected, complete graph, which means everything is connected with everything. In the first phase, we use step one, we use the first theorem. If you have an independence in the data, then you just remove an arc. Remember the theorem was saying if there is an independence, there's no arc, if and only if, in fact. V-structures is the second step. We find those triples and see if the precondition of the theorem is fulfilled. If so, then we orient the arcs. And in step three, we clean up. We orient the edges in the other direction if the precondition of the theorem is not fulfilled, and we avoid cycles. That's what happens here. Let me show it on an example. Let this be the underlying causal graph. We don't know it, but the measurements we have, A, B, C, D, are generated by this graph. What kind of independences will we observe in the data? Can you read that of the graph? Shouldn't be very difficult. Well, the first theorem tells us that there will be two independences because there are two arrows missing here. Yes? Every missing arrow means an independence. A and B are independent because there is no common cause between them, and there is no directed chain from A to B or from B to A. See, this is not a directed connection. So they are independent, unconditionally. A and D are independent too, but we need conditioning because normally A will influence D through C. A causes C, C causes D. So A and D are going to be dependent. So we need to break that connection. So we need to condition on C. If we condition on C, then we break that path. Unfortunately, something funny is happening. When we condition on C, A and B are going to be dependent. We are conditioning on common effect. And then A will influence D through B. So A, B, D. So there's going when we condition on C only, there's going to be dependence between A and D through B. So we need to condition on B and C. And these are the only independences we will find in the data. A and B and then A and D. When we condition on B and C, then they are independent. So let's forget about this graph. We are starting with this. So we don't know the graph. We just have this that we read from the data. We start with a complete graph, undirected complete graph. And then for every independence, that's the first step, we remove a connection. A and B are independent. We remove the arc between A and B. The second independence is A and D. We remove the connection between A and D. So we remove it, this one. And that's all in terms of independences. There is nothing more. So now we proceed with step two, which starts looking at the possible V-structures. So here are the two candidates for V-structures. ACB, remember there should be a triple where the extreme variables are not connected directly. So ACB is a possibility. Here is another possibility, ACD. And that's all. BCD does not qualify because B and D are connected directly. So they can also be oriented towards C, that's possible, but we cannot discover it because we have no way using the axioms we have. B and D are, you cannot make them independent, so you don't know really what happens. So the first one, let's look at ACB. Because A and B are independent, unconditionally, the conditioning set does not contain C, so you can orient the arrows in this direction. And then we look at the other one, ACD. Here, unfortunately, for A and D to be independent, you need to condition on B and C. So C is included in the conditioning set, so the preconditions for the theorem are not fulfilled, and you cannot use that theorem for V structures. In the third step, cleaning up, you need to orient this arrow the other way, because you cannot orient it from C to D. Then you have to orient it from C to D. And the last step is that last arrow, we have to orient it from B to D, because if we orient it from D to B, then there will be a cycle. You cannot have a cycle in these graphs. So we were lucky, we discovered the graph precisely. It's discoverable. Of course, it's a nice example. The output of the algorithm is a pattern. It's a class of graphs in which if you see a directed edge, then the algorithm says that there is a causal connection between A and B in every graph in that class. If you see a bidirectional arc, then it means that there is an arc between A and B, but we don't know which direction it is, A to B or B to A. And the third type of connection is red without arrowheads. There is a direct connection, or there is a common cause between A and B. We don't know. Statistically, we cannot distinguish that. Now, how this whole thing can be useful for you? When you have data, and very often as engineers you are going to collect data, you can use these algorithms to actually analyze your data and find useful things in there. You will find it useful more often than you may realize at first. So it's not just a theoretical presentation. You can actually do useful things with it. I have at least, I think, two times already, and there were people working on their doctorates where these algorithms became useful for them for analyzing data. Okay, here is what I promised you earlier. If you remember, you cannot perform too many independence tests because some of the tests will come out wrongly, statistically, just as noise, and we will commit type 1 errors, which is rejecting H0 when we should not be rejecting it. So what we should do when running these tests, these algorithms, is to change the significance level alpha. One way of compensating for many tests is to reduce the alpha value. If alpha is 1 in 1,000 and you perform 100 tests, you can expect less than 1 wrong result. Yes, one in ten out of 100. So reducing the level alpha makes it harder to reject independence and reduces the type 1 errors. If you can have also type 2 errors, but then you can fight with these by bringing alpha higher. So you can change the alpha level. We should let me now for a moment take a break, and then let's play with the algorithm for a moment. I have the data set for the here it is, I think. Here is what I did with this example from slides is I created a network first. I entered some values in the tables. You see they're coming from my head. I generated a data set. There is a function in the software for generating a data set. Generate data file. And I generated, I think, 10,000 records from this graph. So now, when we have those records, let me get that. Here is the data set. I open it here. We have a data set spanning over 10,000 records, four variables A, B, C, D, and the data set was generated from the graph that I just showed you. So now we can try to learn the graph from this data, learn a new network using the PC algorithm. Let me just first run it. As you see, just like in the example on the slides, I was able to retrieve that graph from the data, to learn it. It's a nice graph that makes it possible to learn. What you should do, there are three parameters here, actually four parameters. This algorithm. This parameter is for determining when a variable is discrete and continuous. When you have a numerical data set, when there are fewer than 20 values in a variable, then we declare it to be discrete, otherwise it's continuous. This is the maximal number of connections that a node can have. That reduces complexity. If you have a very complex set of dependencies, it makes the graph sparser, kind of, you know, in a hard way. This parameter is nice when you have a data set that you don't know. Whenever I'm dealing with a new data set, I usually set it to 30 seconds. If it doesn't come back in 30 seconds, it probably will not come back at all, or it will come back later. So 30 seconds. And this is really the most important parameter, which is the significance threshold. Whenever I have a new data set, I start usually with a very, very low alpha level. As you see, it's one in a gazillion, very, very small value. In this data set, it shouldn't make any difference, really. It's a nice data set, many records, so it didn't make any difference. You can also make it much bigger, like you can make it, let's say, 2 in 10. What will happen, I'll show it on another data set, probably not much difference here. Yeah, no difference. At all alpha values, we get this structure. So let me show you another data set, a real one. There are a few slides on that on the slides. This is a real data set and a real study that I conducted in 1993. The story is the following. Carnegie Mellon, I just finished my doctorate, and the people in the philosophy department, very nice people. I was so impressed by their work that I knew them. They offered me a few months postdoctoral position, and I worked with them on this problem. The management of Carnegie Mellon was worried about low student retention. this variable. This is a real data set where every row is a university in US, measured over 8 variables in this set. The data set comes from a US magazine called US News and World Report. The magazine collects every year data about universities and uses those data to rank universities. I think if we go to Google, I think college rankings, you see, this is. They do it every year. So they and they collect the data set, and then they produce a ranking of universities. Here we are. You can see which universities are, according to that data set, the best. And in the ranking, they use several criteria. One of the criteria is retention, student retention. Let me show you the histogram of this variable. We didn't have such good software at that time, but we did have the algorithm. So let me change the bean size to show you that there exist universities in US that lose around 80% of their students in the first year. Retention means keeping the students. So it shows you the percentage of students that stay after the first year. And it's surprising that some universities lose 80% of their students. These are not academic losses, so they are not kicked out because they didn't pass the exams. They leave for other reasons. We don't know what reasons, really. Maybe it's too expensive, maybe there's too much work, maybe they don't like living in the city, they don't like the university, whatever. So US News and World Report uses this variable as one of the four criteria for ranking. The higher retention, the better. And indeed, you can find strong correlation between the best universities and the retention. So these are the Harvards, MITs, Stanford, you know, the very, very best, Yale, etc. Carnegie Mellon was somewhere here, 50-something, 56% of students stayed, 40-something left. And they were worried because that brought them down in the ranking. And so they asked us to look at the reasons for ranking. What causes retention? So we used these methods. We used the PC algorithm. And by the way, before we let me do that because I don't want to lose that thing. But let me show you something. If you look at the data and the statistics, you will notice that the correlation matrix. I think I've shown you that matrix when we talk about statistics. The correlation matrix is shows you that everything is related to everything. Everything is correlated with everything. So sometimes it's stronger, sometimes it's weaker. So if you want to influence retention, what do? Here is one big correlation: salary. If you start paying the faculty more, will the students stay? Good question. So what exactly is causing the retention? That's the question. As you see, everything is related to everything. When you start learning, the first thing that you get in the structure, let's leave it at 0.05 at first, you'll notice that this is the retention. At 0.05 level, There are only two variables that are directly related to retention. So that means that most of the correlations that you saw were through common causes or through other variables, indirect dependencies. That's already an incredible value when you do this kind of analysis. It tells you the structure of the problem, which things are in the neighborhood, which things are directly related. We noticed these two variables are a way of expressing the quality of incoming students. This is comparable to entrance exams or to the high school end exam, matura, standardized test scores. This is a measure telling that the percentage of students in the university who were in the top 10 of their class of the school. Americans love to rank, you know, in schools competition. They love to be the biggest, the fastest, etc. When I was first in US, I was joking. Guggenheim Museum, which is round. Guggenheim Museum is the roundest building in the world. This is, of course, a joke. The top 10 is the percentage of students who were in the top 10 of their class. Please note that they are related. The relationship is actually quite strong, as you will see in a moment. Probably a common cause. The quality of the students, hardworking and smart students are both scoring high on the exams, and they're also doing well in the class. This is the other cause of potential cause of retention. We don't know which way the arrow goes here. It can go both ways. The statistics is not enough to distinguish that. Student-teacher ratio. So the more faculty you have per student, the fewer students per faculty, the better. Makes sense. But one thing that you notice immediately is that it's not a complete graph. So in the data set, many of the dependencies are indirect, through common causes or through indirect connections. So correlation by itself is not enough. Salary in particular, here it is, you see it has a common cause. There's a common cause between salary and retention. That's what the algorithm is saying. Let me show you two things now that you should always do whenever you analyze a data set. I mentioned to you that you should try very, very low significance value. What happens if you do that? The null hypothesis for every independence test is that the two variables are independent. So when the alpha level is very low, it's going to be very difficult to reject H0, null hypothesis. Yes? It's going to be difficult to reject null hypothesis. Therefore, many of the variables are going to be declared independent. And the graph is going to be very sparse if we do that. Does it make sense? So if I do that, I'm going to get a sparse graph. But why am I doing this? I'm doing this in order to see which connections among the variables are robust. Robust means they are there, right? Still there. Even though it was very difficult to reject independence, it was rejected in this case. So I'm seeing the bottom line. I'm seeing which of the connections I can trust. That's the reason why I'm doing this. Because remember, every time you do any statistical tests, there can be errors. You know that. That's just statistics. Type 1, type 2 errors. So I'm now reducing the possibility of type 1 error by making the alpha level very low. So H0, independence, is not rejected easily. So the places where it is rejected, well, something must be going on there. Yes, at very low level, low significance level, it was still rejected. I can trust these connections. In particular, I'm interested in this variable. This connection, I can trust. I also mentioned to you that these two variables probably have a common cause, and that's a very strong connection between the two. You can, in fact, observe that in the scatter plots. We should do that in a moment. Now let's go back and make the significance level very high. 2.2. That's a very high level. That means that it's very easy to reject independence, H0. Yes, very easy. If I do that, I'm going to get a dense graph. But look at this. Still, only three variables that are directly connected to my variable of interest. That means that I can probably, with a high degree of certainty, limit my search for direct causes to these three variables. Because, otherwise there should be connections with those. It was very easy to reject independence. Still, it wasn't rejected between this variable and this and this and this and this, right? So it's a good idea to try the range to see which things are robust in terms of the influences. These are the potential influences. But when you bring the significance level down, only this will remain. In fact, I know that when I bring it down to 2 in 100, which is not unreasonable for this data set, only one variable remains. Quality of incoming students. These two express that, quality of incoming students. What can you do with these arrows that where we don't know the connection? You can fix them yourself. You can right-click and then say this way or that way. That's knowledge from the outside. You can just edit. How reliable is it? Well, as reliable as your knowledge is. Remember, we are dealing here with Bayesian approach, Bayesian networks. We have the license to enter subjective information here. You know, it's an assumption. If you write a paper and do that, you should write, I decided that it's this way, and you explain why you did that, right? People may or may not believe you. But you can also do another thing. In the algorithm, you can enter background knowledge, and there are three types of background knowledge. You can say, for example, that there is an arrow. You know for sure that there is an arrow between the two variables, so you can draw those arrows. You can forbid arrows. You can say, no, there is no connection from here to here. You can do it both ways, even. There is just no connection between these two variables. So these are two types of knowledge, forcing and forbidding arcs. But there is a third one also that I like most because it's very robust. In this data set, all of the variables are determined at the beginning of the school year. All of these variables, like average spending per student, faculty salary, student-teacher ratio, probability of accepting an offer from the university, admission offer, average test scores, rejection rate. So what percentage of people, of applicants are rejected? Of course, the bigger the rejection rate, the more prestigious the university is. So, and retention we observe at the end of the year. So definitely, it comes later in time. As you know, causality doesn't work backwards in time, at least not in the world we know. Yes. So if you put those things in different temporal tiers, time goes from left to right, the algorithm will never put an arrow from retention, this one, into this. If there is any connection, the arrow is going to go from here to here. So it allows me to influence the direction of the arrows. It's an assumption, but not unreasonable. It is impossible that retention causes any of this. If I do that and use this 0.02 level, you see that the arrow here is going to be put in this direction. We still don't know what's happening there, but in this case, it's irrelevant, really, because we are interested mainly in this. Our conclusion here was that it was the quality of incoming students that influenced the retention. And we reported that. In fact, we wrote a paper about this analysis of the data set. And Carnegie Mellon decided to listen to us, which was very nice. And, I mean, the administration of the university. And they started offering students with the highest test scores partial stipends. You know, the tuition is very high, they need money, so when they are offered a few thousand dollars each year as a stipend, it makes it more likely for them to come. So they started to attract students with the highest test scores. And a year later, they observed significant increase in the retention. I think it was, instead of 50-something, it was 60-something. So they brought it up by 10 points. So it's one of the studies that I know where application of these learning methods, causal discovery methods, was tested empirically. They actually conducted an experiment and found out that it was right. And this is a real data set. You can play with that. So it's kind of nice. Have I shown you everything here? One more thing I will show you, because the next few slides are about this. You need to orient all the arrows in order to learn the model, the parameters. If you want to learn parameters, it will tell you, sorry, you need to fix those arcs. So you need to, you can always do it this way. You can decide which way they should go. We can delete them, of course, or you can press this button, which will assign a random order, just in random order. You learn the parameters here. Here we are. And now we have a model. And the model is learned from a data set that is continuous. Because of the existence of tests, independence tests, for the multivariate normal case, this model is actually multivariate normal. So every relationship is an equation that is linear. If you conducted a regression analysis of retention on test scores, this is what you would get. It's actually a regression, linear regression. This is the coefficient and this is the noise. And when there are multiple parents, like here, we will have a complex equation with four arguments. Four arguments and a linear equation. You can make predictions with it. You can see what happens if you increase the test scores, etc. I also thought it would be useful to look at the correlation, like top 10 and test scores. I think they will be highly correlated because of a common cause. You see, they are very correlated. The same with test scores and retention. There's also a strong correlation, I think. Yeah. So that's, once you know the causal structure, you can do the regression. And that regression makes sense. You can use it further in the prediction. It's on the slides, but since we are in the software, if you have a continuous data set, the PC algorithm will work on discrete data sets. So when you have discrete values or categorical, male, female, old, young, medium, or whatever, or it will work on numerical continuous data sets when the distribution is multivariate normal. Multivariate normal is, there is a theorem in statistics that says essentially that the data set is multivariate normal if every marginal is normal. Is it normal? Not really. It's skewed, right? But it turns out that that independence tests are very robust to skewness. We actually tested it. So you should actually check every single variable if it doesn't depart too much from normality. That doesn't depart too much. Another thing you should check is you should check pairs, because every pair of variables should be linearly dependent. Is it linear? Not bad. You should check every pair, really. If the relationships are linear, is it linear? Maybe like this, and these are outliers. When you do data analysis, what you can do is you can also throw away variables that are outliers. I'm shift clicking, and I can select those rows and press delete button and delete them. These are outliers, right? So that's what you do. I showed you the change of the p-value. It's a good idea, really, to check a whole range. So we can go back to the slides. I actually told you most of the things. The procedure is independent of the distribution, but we need independence tests. And it's the existence of independence tests that limits the applicability to which data sets you can apply it. You can always discretize the data, but there are some statistical problems with discretization. When you discretize, you introduce spurious dependencies, and that's a problem. So I told you about this thing, normal marginals, linear relationships. You should check linearity of the relationships, and then you can do the analysis the way I did that. Let's see, maybe this is a good moment to actually stop in terms of the material. We have 4 minutes before the end. Next time, which is after the long weekend, I'll tell you about the other approach to learning. It will take much less in terms of slides. It's much easier to present, but the connection between causality and the whole procedure, the algorithm, is much more obscure. Since we have a couple of minutes, let me show you another thing. If you have a graph like this, let me do this, and if you have a graph like this, something is happening here. No, everything is okay. Let me get the data also for it. This graph is going to be not distinguishable from other graphs where y is the common cause, remember? Because the independences you will see here is that x and everything is dependent on each other, but when you condition on y, x and z become independent. But the same thing happens when y is a common cause of the two. So this is a graph that you will not be able to discover. Let's look at the data generated from this graph. I just generated it from this graph. When we do the learning here, PC algorithm, exactly what you would expect. We don't know which way the arrows go. And this could be a common cause, or this could be the direction. And there could be also common causes between the pairs here. That could be indeed happening. We don't know. So we can randomly assign the direction, learn the parameters. Here is a graph that we learned. And there's a function also in the software to go back to the pattern. When you go to learning, show pattern, it shows you the pattern, the equivalence class to which the graph belongs. So if you want to discover something and you have an idea of what the graph is, you can actually check, you can draw the graph and you can check the equivalence class to see if you can, in principle, discover that graph. Let me do one more. For the graph that we learned, for the retention, you can also see the pattern. The pattern does not consider knowledge from outside. Remember, this was the graph. I managed to orient this arrow through knowledge from the outside, through temporal precedence. But we are getting precisely the graph that the algorithm discovered. One more thing before we stop. Let's look at that faithfulness violation, remember? What will happen here? Where it's violated, the faithfulness. Let me generate a data file first. Let me generate 10,000 records. Oh, it's there actually. Let me replace it. Open it. And let's see what happens when we try to discover this graph. Something very funny. Actually, not bad. I don't know how it happened that it actually didn't put a connection between them. I guess the other things. What if I make the alpha level different? The same. So actually, not bad. Maybe it discovered that there's no error here by conditioning. If you condition on these two things, they are independent. Maybe that it discovered these connections as genuine dependencies, and even though there was, they all were also independent. Anyway, it got fooled. Didn't discover that graph. Great. I'm out of time. We'll continue with the other algorithm and practical things around. Hopefully, this is going to be useful for you in data analysis whenever you have any data to analyze. Thank you very much, and I wish you a good long weekend.